We're going to Genesis chapter 22, continuing our series through Genesis. This is message number 23, and the title of this message is Knife in Hand. Genesis chapter 22, we'll be looking at the whole chapter, but we're going to read verses 1 and 2 to get started. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. So chapter 21 recounted the fulfillment of the critical seed promise to Abraham with the birth of Isaac. After 25 years of sojourning in the land of Canaan and having promises of a seed who would become a great nation, Abraham and Sarah finally have a son. And the account emphasizes once again that God spoke, and it was so, concerning this promise. Now, the fulfillment of the promise did not end all conflict or all obstacles for Abraham and Sarah. In fact, Hagar and Ishmael, her son, present a conflict in regard to Abraham's heir. So by the request of Sarah and the assurance of God that confirmed his promises concerning Ishmael, Abraham sent them away out of his household. Now, Hagar and Ishmael, they go out into the wilderness and they run out of supplies. They're without help, seeming certain to die in the wilderness. And then the angel appears to them, confirming God's promises concerning Ishmael, meaning that he would not die. Indeed, he would become a great nation, as God had said. And of course, they find the water that sustains them. Now, the removal of Ishmael from Abraham's household doesn't remove all the conflicts for Abraham, as Abraham had this conversation with Abimelech at the end of the chapter, and they both made a covenant of non-aggression, you might say, toward each other. And the episode brings back into the account the promise of the land that Abraham had received as well, and that that promise has not been fulfilled. Abraham is still a stranger in the land without possession of it. And the account ends then with Abraham settling down for many days in the Philistines' land, which lends a little bit of permanence to Abraham, a little bit of settledness to he and Sarah. So now as we come to chapter 22, chapter 22 is the real climax of the Abraham section of Genesis. So Abraham's life doesn't end here, and there'll be a little bit more about him over the next few chapters, but nevertheless, this is the crucial point of the account of Abraham's life of faith concerning God's promises to him. And after this, the book then transitions to Isaac, and there's a little bit of overlap between the two in that transition. But the whole Abraham account has featured obstacle after obstacle, conflict after conflict, and just when it seems like everything is resolved for Abraham, it seems like, well, here's another conflict, here's another obstacle, here's another difficulty to overcome in the promises that God had made to them. So here again, we meet with another obstacle in Abraham's life. And the obstacle here, though, is of a very different kind than what he has faced before. Because here, Abraham is commanded by God to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. And so now he finally, after all this time, he has the promised son, and now he is to be killed. So we're going to look at this chapter in two parts, verses 1 to 14, where we read about the sacrifice on the mountain, and verses 15 to 24, where the covenant promises to Abraham are confirmed. So we'll start with the first part in sacrifices on the mountain. Let's look at verses 1 and 2 again. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. So Moses opens this particular episode, and we don't get any sort of a time marker. We get the ending of chapter 21 that says that he dwelt in the Philistines' land for many days, so we don't know how much time has passed. I mean, obviously, Isaac is considerably grown by this time, just from some of the facts of the account. But we really don't know when this happened. Sometime, obviously, after the events of chapter number 21. But Moses begins this episode and gives us this comment at the beginning that gives us theological insight into the episode. So he says that it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham, and then he gets into the account. And again, that's sort of one of those editorial type comments that we've talked about before when you're reading a historical narrative. And he states explicitly that God is testing Abraham. Now, the word that's used here could be translated test. Tempt is a fine translation. As long as we understand that God did not tempt Abraham to sin. In other words, James chapter 1, verses 13 to 14 says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed." In other words, temptation to sin is that comes from within us, and we are enticed, and God does not tempt us with sin, nor did he tempt Abraham with sin. But again, the word really has the idea of test, probably more than what we think of today in terms of tempt. Because the word means to prove the quality of something. To prove the quality. It could be proving the quality of a person. It could be proving the quality in the sense of maybe like testing a metal, testing it for its purity. That's really what the word is getting at. It's a proving, a testing or a proving. Now, God had tested Abraham's faith prior to this, his last covenant affirmation to Abraham before he died. Now, God commanded Abraham here to take Isaac to this land of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering upon one of the mountains there. Now, we don't know where this land was exactly, and we're not given any more specifics about it, really. From verse 4 in this chapter, we know that it was a three-day journey from wherever it was in the exact location in Beersheba where Abraham was. But other than that, we don't really have any more specifics. Now, in 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse number 1, Moriah is the same name as the name of a mountain on the east side of Jerusalem where Solomon built the temple. But there's nothing that actually connects these two as being the same place in the Bible. It's possible that they were the same. We're not told that. And of course, Abraham goes to this place more than 1,000 years before Solomon builds this temple. So there's just no way for us to know for sure. And the Bible does not explicitly connect the two anywhere. Now, Moses' account refers to this land of Moriah. In other words, he doesn't say go to the mountain of Moriah. He says go to the land of Moriah, and he's going to show him which mountain he wants him to go up into when he gets there. So obviously, this refers to some sort of a land or a region of which there are many mountains, and God will show him which one in particular that he is to go to when he gets there. And obviously, we can see some echoes of God's initial call to Abraham to journey to the land that he would show him when he set out from Ur of the Chaldees and then later from Haran. Look at verses 3 to 10 now. "And Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son and clave the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went unto the place which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father and said, My father. And he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together. And they came to the place which God had told him of, and Abraham built an altar there, and laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him upon the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son." Now, the way Moses tells this account is intriguing. The descriptions that Moses gives here are very drawn out with many details given. And he gives a lot of details that as you go on reading the account, you realize don't have a lot of relevancy. They don't have a lot of effect in terms of the point of the account. For instance, he tells us that he saddled the donkey. He tells us that he took two young men. He tells us that he cut the wood, that he saw the place from afar. And this goes on and on and on. In fact, as you read this, it's all these descriptions of all these different actions and different details on this way to getting up there. And even at the end in verse 10, Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Now, so the way that this narrative is told to us is interesting. There's a lot of things, in fact, when you look at it, that we're not told. We're not told, what did Sarah think about Abraham taking Isaac away on a 3-day journey to go and offer him as a sacrifice on the altar? For that matter, we're not even told what Abraham thought about this. We're not told what Isaac thought about this. We're not told what the two young men thought about this on the way. So there's a lot of things that we're not told and a lot of things that we are told that don't seem to be really extremely necessary. I mean, is it necessary for us to know that he put a saddle on the donkey before he takes off on this trip? And if he took wood, then he obviously would have had to have cut it, or he would have had to have gathered wood in manageable pieces in order to be able to transport. So what do we do with this sort of a section? And again, this is several verses where we get all this drawn out description. We get very little spoken word. We hear little from Isaac or from Abraham, and nothing from the young men. Well, the point is not for us to try to invest significance that's not there and start allegorizing everything to mean something else. This is actually an example of what we might refer to as poetic prose. And that seems like an oxymoron, because typically prose, it would be opposite of poetry. Poetic construction would be one thing, prose would be something else. This is sort of a blending. All right, now this is not a poem, it's not a psalm, it's not written as a song to be sung or anything like that, but it does have a very poetic type of structure. So as Moses writes this, and he's drawing out all of these details, and he's drawing out all this description that's leading up to Abraham on the mountain, it serves a literary purpose that is easy for us to miss. And it's easy for us to miss for a couple of reasons. One of those being, we already know what happens. And so it's easy for us to miss what the point is in the way that Moses is telling this particular account. And another way that it's easy for us to miss is that we just automatically assume it's old, it's the Bible, it's boring, and it's meant to be boring. So it's giving us long, drawn-out descriptions of things. And again, this misses the point. So this is written in a way to have a certain effect. So that, and again, that's the poetic aspect. It's written to have a certain effect, just like when things are written with great word pictures or great imagery. And oftentimes things are described in a certain way to get us to feel. We've talked about in some of the Psalms, as David has described in some of the Psalms, of being, you know, in a confined and enclosed space. And we almost can experience that as we're reading. We almost can feel sort of that claustrophobia of being in an enclosed space, as according to those descriptions. All right, so this is an example of that. That doesn't happen in a psalm. This happens in prose. It happens in a historical narrative. So what it does is it builds dramatic tension and it builds suspense. And again, one reason why we miss that is because we know how this turns out. But imagine, if you can at all, about reading this without knowing how this turns out. And you realize you're just sort of getting in agony as he's putting the saddle on the donkey, and you're thinking, what happens? What happens? You know, and he's gathering the wood, he's cutting the wood, and all of these sort of things. And you're thinking, what happens? What happens? So it builds this dramatic tension. It builds this suspense. We are not given the thoughts or emotional reactions of Abraham and Isaac in this account. I don't think that we should take from that there was just sort of this stoicism, that they had no sort of of emotional response to what was taking place or no sort of conflicting thoughts about what was taking place. I don't think that's the point at all. But we're not told their inner thoughts. We're given very little of their own words in this episode. We get some words, but very little about that. What are we given? We are given drawn out, detailed descriptions of actions. That's what we're given. And that's the point. What's the effect that it has? Well, again, if we can read it sort of with fresh eyes, so to speak, the effect is that it focuses our attention on the actions of Abraham. So if you're maybe reading a book and there's a very suspenseful section, maybe you're watching a movie or something, there's a very suspenseful section, and you're sort of hanging on to every little action, and you're sort of wondering, you know, is there significance to that? You know, they pick up a cup and there's a ring left and they zoom in on it and you're thinking, is there significance to this? You're hanging on to every little action. You sort of get hyper-observant in those kind of settings. Well, that's the effect. All right, so it's focusing our attention on the actions of Abraham. And the actions of Abraham are the actions of faith obeying the word of God. So all of these actions, again, they might seem in a way irrelevant, that they're not really giving us information, but that's not really the point to give us information. What this section is doing is showing us Abraham acting in faith. He's obeying the word of God. And obviously, this does build a certain amount of tension for the reader to see how that God will resolve this new kind of obstacle for Abraham and the fulfillment of God's covenant with him. Now again, we've seen obstacle after obstacle as we've been going, but this is something new. This is something different. This is very different than a famine in the land, for instance. This is different than Abraham's wife Sarah being barren, for instance. This is a different kind of obstacle. And so we're wondering, we've seen to this point that God has always acted in such a way to uphold and to fulfill his word. So how is this going to be resolved? Again, that's the effect that we get from what we are reading. So they journey for 3 days, and they came to this place that God had told Abraham to go. And again, we're not given a direction. We don't know what direction that they went in 3 days in. We don't know any of those things. And again, it could be that perhaps this is the same place as east of Jerusalem. It's possible that it could be, but we don't know that. And again, there's nothing biblically beyond the name to connect the places. So Abraham takes Isaac alone up on the mountain. And Isaac asks, he speaks for the first time. And when Isaac speaks for the first time in the account, he asks about the lamb for a burnt offering because they don't have one. And Abraham responds with what is a central, crucial statement in this chapter, and that's in verse number 8. And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide himself a lamb for the burnt offering." So they went both of them together. Abraham said, "God will provide," is how he answered Isaac, which Abraham believed. And he doesn't get any more specific than that, but Abraham believed that God would provide. Now, the deliberate description continues then. He builds the altar. Everything is prepared. The wood is laid out in order. It's arranged on the altar. Isaac is bound. Isaac is laid on the altar that Abraham built, all the way to Abraham stretching out his hand, taking the knife to slay his son. So the effect is also that we know Abraham was determined to obey. We see him going through all of these actions and journeying for 3 days. So in other words, Abraham doesn't receive this word and then just act in some sort of a knee-jerk response. You know, we can do that sometime. We refer sometimes, you know, to just ripping the Band-Aid off kind of thing. You know, we can just take a rash action that we do something, but this is not the case with Abraham. It says he rose up the next morning after God had commanded him this. He gets all of these things together. They journey for 3 days. They get up to the mountain. They're going through all of this process. And again, Moses keeps giving us these long, drawn-out descriptions of all of this. Abraham was determined to obey. Every action that he's taken is an action of faith. Now, we can imagine, obviously, the anguish that it must have caused him. I don't think the point of the narrative would be to think that Abraham is not experiencing any sort of anguish, any sort of internal struggle or conflict over this. I'm sure that he was. But the fact that he journeyed 3 days shows that Abraham had to think about this. He had to prepare himself for what God had told him to do. And everything in the account tells us that Abraham is determined to do it. Then we come to verses 11 to 14. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. So as Abraham has taken the knife to slay Isaac, the angel of Yahweh, this is the pre-incarnate Christ, as we've talked about that before, he speaks from heaven to stop Abraham from killing Isaac on the altar. So God's test has shown the quality, or has shown the faith of Abraham. And that is what God was testing in Abraham. And in the midst of a supremely difficult trial that Abraham couldn't have understood the purpose of, Abraham had shown his faith to be genuine faith. I mean, it's something else that we're not told in the account. Other than God testing Abraham, why that he would do that? Why would he make this the test? Why, all the things that Abraham has been through, all the things that have happened to this point, why would this be the test? And we're not told why. And Abraham wasn't told why, at least that in any way that we know of. And so though he could not understand the reason, Abraham was shown to be faithful by his actions. Abraham sees then this ram that is caught by its horns. And he takes it and he offers it instead of Isaac. He offers it in the place of Isaac on this altar as a burnt offering. And then he gives the place a name, Yahweh Jireh, meaning Yahweh will see, or Yahweh will provide. And it says that it became something of a saying that meant in the midst of difficulty and beyond the limits of human strength or resource, God will see and God will provide for his word to be fulfilled and his people to be preserved. So what took place on the mountain there sort of served as a stabilizer or a strengthener, as a bracer for people of faith. Then we come to the end of this chapter, this second part, verses 15 to 24, where we see the covenant promises confirmed. Let's start with verses 15 to 18. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. So Abraham... No, let's stop right there. So that's the baby by voice. All right, so Christ speaks to Abraham again. And this time, he gives a confirmation of God's covenant with Abraham. And in fact, this is the last covenant confirmation that Abraham received before he died that we are aware of. And Abraham's faith, if you look at these words in the exchange here, Abraham's faith is emphasized, and the covenant promises are confirmed. So he confirms that he's going to bless Abraham greatly. And of course, this reflects chapter 12 and verse number 2. That he's going to multiply Abraham's seed. And that reflects chapter 13, verse 16, chapter 15, verse 5, and chapter 17, and verse 2. And of course, we know in this promised seed, there were a few things that were promised to Abraham. He was promised that many nations would come from him. Not just the one nation, and not just this one promised seed as Isaac his son, but many nations would come from him. There'd be many offspring that would come from Abraham as a result of God's blessing on him, including Isaac and including the nation that would come from Isaac and from Jacob. There's also a promise here of possession of the land that has been promised to Abraham, to that seed, to that nation of him. This reflects chapter 12, verse 7, chapter 13, verse 15, chapter 15, verse 18, chapter 17, verse 8. Now, what we get here is the mention of enemies. Now, and that is the first time that we have seen it put that way in this Genesis account. Your seed, now referring to that nation from him and from Isaac and from Jacob, will possess the gates of his enemies. And this mention of enemies obviously foreshadows the conquest that will come after the Exodus, but also that latter day conflict and the return of Christ to establish his kingdom, because that is when they will actually finally possess the land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then we also see the confirmation gives, the confirming the blessings through Abraham, through that nation, through their possession of the land to all the nations of the earth, reflecting again Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3 and chapter 18 and verse number 18. So God swore these promises to Abraham. We're told by himself that he swore, or by his own name, as the writer of Hebrews puts it, Hebrews chapter 6 verses 13 to 15. For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he sware by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. Now Abraham's faith is evidenced by his obedience, and that is emphasized. Abraham's faith is emphasized at the beginning and at the ending of this covenant confirmation that is given by the angel of Yahweh. And then the chapter ends in verses 19 to 24. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. And it came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah, she hath also borne children unto thy brother Nahor, Huz his firstborn, and Buz his brother, and Kemuel the father of Aram, and Hesed, and Hasso, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. And Bethuel begat Rebekah. These eight Milcah did bear to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine, whose name was Reuma, she bare also Taba, and Gaham, and Fahash, and Maaca. So Abraham returns to his settled place, back to where he was before he set out on this three-day journey. And the chapter ends with this genealogy of Abraham's brother Nahor, which the purpose of this genealogy actually introduces Rebekah, whom Isaac will later marry, and also introduces the family from whom Jacob will marry Leah and Rachel as well. And so obviously this is getting ready now for this transition that is going to take place as the book of Genesis continues on. So now we want to think about chapter 22 and what it's teaching, what it's contributing to this story of Abraham. The only reference to the episode in Genesis 22 outside of Genesis 22 is in Hebrews 11. And so I'm going to read this. I'm going to read a little more of the context here in Hebrews 11. This is verses 8 to 19. This is all of the verses pertaining to Abraham that includes reference to this episode. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles or tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, But having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country that is in heavenly. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. He that had received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. And again, this is the only mention or reference to this episode that we have outside of Genesis 22. The writer of Hebrews points out that Abraham believed that God would raise Isaac from the dead. In other words, Abraham fully intended to go through with this sacrifice. When he took Isaac up onto that mountain and all the preparations and things that he made, in Abraham's mind, he believed that he was going to literally offer his son Isaac as an offering, as a sacrifice on this altar. And he trusted that God would raise him from the dead. Why? Because God had specifically promised that Isaac was the son of promise. And in Isaac would Abraham's seed be called. He was the inheritor of the covenant. And the one in whom Abraham's seed would be called, referring again to the nation of Israel. Now, if you think about the rest of the Genesis account from this point forward, you realize that it focuses or revolves around death for Abraham. First of all, you get the death of Sarah. You get the burial place that Abraham buys. And then you get Abraham's death himself. And then Abraham is gone out of the Genesis account. We follow on with Isaac. Then we go on to Jacob and so on. So then what is Genesis 22 teaching us? God is here teaching resurrection as Isaac was figuratively slain and figuratively raised from the dead. That's what the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter number 11. Abraham believed that God would raise Isaac from the dead, and he received Isaac in a figure of resurrection, or as though he were raised from the dead. The point is that Isaac was figuratively slain and was figuratively raised from the dead and then would go on to inherit the promises. And that's crucial, because what does that mean for Abraham? Well, the writer of Hebrews also points out that Abraham did not receive the full fulfillment of the promises in his lifetime. Rather, he says, Abraham died in faith, meaning that he would receive full fulfillment in the resurrection, just like was shown to him in a figure through his son, Isaac. So, chapter 21 and 22 overcome two important obstacles, the obstacles of life and the obstacles of death. Life was seen to be as no obstacle preventing God from fulfilling his promises. Abraham and Sarah had no child, but God brought forth life from the dead bodies of Abraham and Sarah, which is what the writer of Hebrews points out. Death was no obstacle either, since it did not nullify his promises. So if Isaac is figuratively slain and he's figuratively raised from the dead to go on and inherit the promises, Abraham is being shown that death will not nullify the promises of God. Those promises are not just for Abraham while he is alive, and then after he dies, they're just handed off to Isaac. And then after Isaac dies, they're just handed off to Jacob, and on and on and on and on. Those promises are to Abraham, and he will possess those promises. They will be fulfilled to him. Not in this life, though. After death, they will be fulfilled in the resurrection. So death was no obstacle. It did not nullify the promises. And that's an important truth, that the reward of faith is had in the resurrection and not in this life. You see, Abraham's getting near the end of his life. By the time we get here, yes, we're going to read a little bit more about him, but Sarah's going to die. It's not going to be that long, especially in the narrative, before Abraham dies. He's getting very near to death. What becomes of the promises to Abraham? Well, they'll be perpetuated in his posterity, in his descendants, yes, but he also himself has hope of one day receiving the full promises and inheriting this land that was promised to him in the kingdom of the Messiah. This is why Paul refers to the resurrection of the dead as the hope of Israel in Acts chapter 28 and verse number 20. So Abraham's faith was a resurrection faith. What kind of faith did Abraham have? Abraham had a resurrection faith. Abraham had faith in life, and Abraham had faith in death. And that is what was tested and what was proven in this chapter. Resurrection faith, then, is also what every one of us must have in order to see salvation. Faith in Jesus Christ for us is not believing that he will give us our best lives now. That is not biblical faith in Jesus Christ. That's not resurrection faith. But believing that he died, he was buried, and he rose from the dead in order to conquer death and hell, that all who believe might be raised from the dead to eternal life in his kingdom. That's the kind of faith that we are called to have. That's the kind of faith that Abraham had that was tested and was proven in this chapter. That's the kind of faith that Moses referred to earlier in Genesis chapter 15 and verse number 6, that he believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. That's the kind of faith that Abraham died with, that the writer of Hebrews is talking about, and that's the kind of faith that we must have if we are to truly inherit eternal life.